Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach. I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? Thanks for inviting me out. And I think this is a good idea to celebrate Bill's sobriety date. And I like the lineup of people that you have because I'm looking forward to listening to them. They're some of my favorites. And I've been asked to kick this off by talking about the steps one and steps two. I was trying to think how to start it on how important Bill thought these steps were. And it occurred to me that on page 60 of the big book, there's a line that says, being convinced we were at step three. So we have 60 pages devoted to one and two, plus 20 pages in the Roman numerals that are leading up to, and I think we're up to 40 pages in the big book before we get to step two. So there must be something incredibly important that happens in the taking of step one. And I'm of the opinion that if it doesn't happen, the recovery is nowhere near what it could be, and in many cases doesn't work. And we can look back, coming around 5 years or something, or wondering why people with 3 years have gone by us. We can see how serene they are, and they seem to be getting a much better handle on things. And in many cases, if we look back, it has to do with the fact that we did not take step one in its entirety, that we did not sit down long enough to understand the full implications of the first step and what it means. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And so that's what I'm going to try and do tonight, is to share what I think needs to be done in order to put ourselves in the maximum position to have the rest of the program work. I came up with a trick question, which is, there's many answers to the question, but I'm going to just say, give you mine. Why is AA a spiritual program? Now, the answer I came up with, because it has to be. And you go, well, why does it have to be? Because the disease of alcoholism requires nothing less. In other words, there's no non-spiritual answer to this problem. And that's saying a lot. In other words, it has to be a spiritual program. There's just no other way of addressing the situation that we have. And so we start out just reading the doctor's opinion. And I can imagine I wasn't asked to read it when I first came in. We were slow up in Washington. I swear we didn't get around to the steps until about 4 years. We just put the plug in the jug and went to meetings. And there were different parts of the country that did that. I mean, some of the old timers just said, just put the plug in the jug and go. And so I became familiar with a lot of this later on, and became totally engrossed in the steps and the spiritual part, and realized that how much I had minimized my own surrender in the beginning. And I came in out of a nut ward with the straitjacket and the wristband and all of those things, and still found myself thinking that my case wasn't as bad as yours. That it's just, I got a problem, but I am setting it up in my own mind that it's not this urgent one that the book talks about. And so in that part in the doctor's opinion where Dr. Silkworth said, nothing less than a complete psychic change will ensure recovery. In other words, it's saying to the new alcoholic, we want you to sit down and think about your situation until you agree that unless you have a complete psychic change, you have no hope of recovery. Now, that's not what a lot of people own up to when we come in. Yeah, I got a little problem with drinking, but I certainly don't need a complete psychic change. That's an overkill for my problem. I need a good home group and a sponsor, and I'll get to meetings, I'll go to conventions, and I'll be fine. And Tom and I were together not too long ago, and we were talking about nowadays compared to the old days, and in order to make this point, one of us came up with the fact that maybe 60 years ago, in a good-sized city and in every town, there was only one meeting. One meeting a week, and people were staying sober at a higher percentage than people are staying sober today. So you imagine yourself, now how are you going to stay sober on one meeting a week? Well, one thing, you're going to be really looking forward to that meeting. That's going to be one thing that's going on. It's going to be a pretty important event in your life. Well, two more days and I'll be at that meeting. And then the second thing is you probably find somebody else who's in that group and maybe meet them for coffee to break up the week. Mostly, you prayed like hell and prayed and prayed and prayed. And now we have 6 a.m. meetings, 8 a.m. meetings, noon meetings, 4 o'clock meetings, midnight meetings, conventions, clubhouses, CDs, pamphlets on every single thing in the world. We have a support system that is so widespread, you don't have to hardly pray at all. See, I'm talking about your personal spiritual growth. You don't have to hardly pray at all. I mean, and when we think about that, let's say, just hypothetically, that it's possible to have fairly good sobriety, having put in a good effort in the beginning and then sort of allowing the support system to hold you there at a level of pretty good sobriety. And Bill, I think somewhere quoted Abraham Lincoln as saying, the good was the biggest enemy of all of the best. And I think that the point of the program is to experience the best, which is a close relationship with a personal higher power. There's some sentences that make the point that I haven't memorized, and so sometimes I will take a big book or a 12 and 12 out and read what I'm trying to say, and that's because my memory is, it's getting embarrassing. But one of them is in There Is a Solution. This is the reason these are important things is this is the thinking process or the education process or whatever, the explanation process that ought to go into allowing each one of us to understand the nature of our problem. And it's funny that this is the chapter called There Is a Solution. And when you stop and think about it, a solution has no value unless there's a problem. Who needs a solution if you don't have a problem? So the whole point of this is, how big a problem do we have? And the bigger the problem, the more need there is for a solution. And so it is in the understanding of the magnitude of the problem. And so where Bill writes there is a solution, he gives us a little glimpse of what should happen to each of us. And as I read this, you've all read the big book a million times. This is page 25. See if this is, we could all stand up and say, yep, that's exactly what happened to me. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had to come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us to do but pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And then, boy, there is no transition. He just goes, we have found much of heaven and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less. So this is sort of a summary of what is the essence of what happens to someone who tries this program from the vantage point of powerlessness. The great fact is this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellow, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. What a gift that is, to have a very personal experience where we are absolutely certain that our own Creator is now in our hearts and is causing the world to take on an entirely new dimension, as Dr. Silkworth suggested, an entire psychic change. Well, when we hear all this stuff, we just go, whoa. You know, what I want is to get my job back. That's what I want. You say the doctor's opinion says you have to have an entire psychic change. Well, maybe I'll get another opinion. He's not the only doctor in the world. I got dough. I'm going to go around and I'm going to explore. And I'm going to find somewhere a doctor who can show me a non-spiritual solution to alcoholism. And he searches and he searches. Now, this is fictitious, just making it up to make a point. And he searches and searches and he finds a guy, and the guy says, yes, I do, and I've seen it work. And I can give you both a short-term solution and a long-term solution. Well, I'd like to hear about it. He said, okay, short-term solution. You go up to a street corner where a cop is standing with no warning, bam him. Try to knock them out. Knock them right down. This should get you 6 months. And if you're in the jails in this town, there will be no booze, and you will come out with 6 months sobriety, guaranteed. Now, the problem is, after you're out, it won't be long before you're drinking again, and you're going to need another short-term solution. And if you keep repeating this, you can get 6 months, 6 months, 6 months, 6 months, and that's our short-term solution. What about the long-term solution? Kill the cop. Now, I make these things up to make a point. There isn't a non-spiritual solution to this disease. And so now we're back to this Dr. Silkworth, an entire psychic change. We're powerless over this. I mean, it's like we start squirming. We start going, You mean I have to reassess my own assessment of how bad it is? And I can remember my sponsor finally got me to be honest. And he just said, well, tell me about your life. You know, what is it like to be inside of you? And I said, oh, I want to make sure no one's listening. It's awful in here. You won't believe how awful it is in here. I'm afraid all the time. I don't know what the hell's going on. I know people don't like me. I can't decide anything, and I yell at myself all the time. I stay up all night long. I'm sweating. I'm anxious. I'm just going around, you know, and that was happening while I was flying airplanes. It's just, rah, 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 you're a piece of crap. You're, yeah, I know, but would you let up a little? I'm trying to land on the carrier. Oh, no, you're rotten. You're no good. It's just awful in here. And then, like, you know, and then I had seizures and blackouts and fitness reports that were terrible. And then I finally had a grand mal seizure, and I've been locked up for 6 months in the nut ward. I've never been so depressed. I'm sick, malnutrition. I lost 50 pounds. And he said, well, you know, if you keep drinking, it's going to get bad. What he was trying to tell me was, your problem is much worse than the one you just described. I'm going, worse, worse. So the point of all of this is to come to grips with the exact nature of being powerless. A lot of times we come up with the idea, and I did. The person whose opinion I respect the most is mine. I mean, I listen to me when I won't listen to anyone else. I don't know about you all. And I remember coming in here, and my sponsor was trying to have me listen to someone else instead of me, which I thought was preposterous. I know more about me than anyone else in the world. Why would I listen to someone else? And he said, well, they're not in a nut ward. I said, okay, I'll listen to them till I get out. Such is the resistance of our own self-centered ego to listening to anyone else except ourselves. And as we're taking the first step, we have to be led down the road where we're going to rely on everything other than ourselves. As a matter of fact, the entire program is set up so that we rely on everything except ourselves. Self-reliance is gone. Self-sufficiency, Bill writes about that all the time. We have to get rid of that. Well, what's going to take its place? You know, somewhere in the 12 and 12, I'll be the hole in the donut. Who will I be? And it turns out that we have a problem so serious that we have to put aside the rules and regulations of the material world and start learning the rules and regulations, I don't call them more, the principles of the spiritual side, which is what this entire program is. And since we've spent our entire life being controlled by all of these ideas from the material success, and they're all true. I look back on them, and almost every lesson I was told was true except one. I was told that if I studied hard in school, I would get high grades. If I got high grades, I could get into college. If I studied hard in college, I could graduate very high in my class and I could get a good job. And if I worked hard at the job, I could get promoted. And if I got promoted, I could work hard and be creative, and then I would earn a lot of money. And when I earned a lot of money, then I could get married and have a family and have two cars and be respected in the neighborhood and then buy a yacht. And then eventually I'd have a great big house with a large bank account, and all of that was true. But then came the lie. And then you'll be happy. See, happiness does not occur out there, because if we were happy, we wouldn't need to buy any crap. And the whole system would collapse. So we got to keep going. Don't forget, you're unhappy. Buy Adidas. You're unhappy, you're unhappy, you're unhappy. Yeah, I am. What's missing? Whatever it is, Jaguar, money, prestige. So those are the rules, and we played by them, but we did finally find out, but you don't get happy. And then we come over on this side, and we find out what the deal was. And one of the books that Bill mentions in the big book is Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. And I remember trying to read that when I had about a year. If you have about a year, forget it. Don't even go near it. It's too hard. This guy is too smart. He's talking in all different languages. He's quoting people. I mean, he was a great educator, and of course was the father of psychology in the United States. And he didn't write a book. He gave a series of 19 lectures at Edinburgh University. In the 1892 or something like that. And they asked him to come over, and all the intellectuals of Europe were going to be there. And they said, would you mind coming over and addressing religion? And he talked to his brother, who was a famous writer, and he said, I've always wanted to think about religion. You know what I mean? It was like a guy that liked to study things. You know, I'm going to study astronomy, I'm going to study this, and I've always wanted to study religion. So that's what he did. He just thought about it and studied, and then he went over and gave these lectures that went on, you know, they were long. And he went on and on to describe what he saw when he studied all of the religions and what has religion contributed to civilization. And to make a long story short, he basically concluded that the pomp and circumstances and the creeds and the hierarchy and the entire church structures and all of that had not contributed anything. Nothing. Sounds like a pretty bad rap, doesn't it? Well, he wasn't finished. He said, however, because of religions, there have been a large number of individuals who have had profound spiritual experiences. And those individuals are the most precious thing that ever happened to mankind. People like Bill Wilson. One profound spiritual experience, and you and I are having a pretty good life. And so, you know, you can go back through saints and different people, or Gandhi, I suppose, and people like that. And so that was his assessment, that was the real value, and therefore they're very important. Because these people, these teachers, these messengers have contributed the most valuable thing that has ever happened to our civilization. Just his point, it's just his opinion, but it's an interesting way of looking at things. And then he came up with a wrap-up at the end. And he said, all religions can be described in two-word sentences, the dynamics of all the religions. And the first sentence was, an uneasiness. That was the first, just two words, period. And he went on to say that men and women at their very best, when they're doing their very best, are still aware that there's something wrong. They don't know what it is, but they are aware there's something missing, there's something wrong, and they have an uneasy feeling about it. So that was one. Two, it's solution. In other words, that's basically what he said. So the churches are going, you know that uneasiness? Yeah. Come here. We have the answer to it. We have the solution. And so they had identified, or he had identified, that this uneasy feeling was really a spiritual problem. Now, out in the material world, it's not treated as a spiritual problem. I don't know how many diagnoses we make of that particular situation. I don't know, Doc. I just have this feeling there's something missing in my life. I've done all this, and I don't know. I'm feeling a little depressed. I'm feeling a little this. Not many of them go, oh, that's the old spiritual uneasiness. You need to find a spiritual program. There aren't many that do that. And so we get many other answers to this because it is a material world, and it would be a rare bird where you had a top-line psychiatrist who would look at this problem and go, I can tell you what it is. You need a spiritual experience. But if we know AA history, we all know of one just like that. When Dr. Young looked at Roland Hazard, a millionaire who came to him because he had experienced everything that the United States had to offer, and unless he could find a way of staying sober, it was pretty clear that he was not going to be the success that his father was, and he was not going to have the wonderful life that his father had, that he would probably end up in a sanitarium. And the consensus was that Carl Jung was probably his last hope, because this was a psychiatrist who had branched out and had a broader perspective than Freud, and had talked in limited way about spiritual things. And so he went there and spent a year, and Dr. Jung tried to cause the profound personality change, and at the end of the year he told them that he had done everything he can for him. You understand, if you drink again you'll probably end up in a sense. Oh yeah, I understand all that. And not long after Roland left, he was with friends and somebody said, you want a drink? And he said, yeah, that would be great. And he had a drink and boom, he's an alcoholic. We know that his life started collapsing. And so he went back to Dr. Jung. And he said, I need more help. I don't want it to end up. What can I do? What can I do? What can I do? And this is that situation that I was making fun of earlier. Where are you going to find a psychiatrist that's going to look at this guy, a millionaire, charge any fee you want? And he looked at him and he said the great words that are so helpful to our program. There's nothing I can do for you. That is called helping someone take a first step. You follow what I'm saying? You know, when at the end of chapter, or when we read chapter 5, we get to the ABCs, where alcoholic couldn't manage our own lives, and then B. What B say? No human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Every time I read that, I think to Dr. Jung. This is it. There's no human power beyond him, and that human power just looked me in the eye and said, there's nothing I can do for you. That just about rules out anything on the planet helping you. It almost ensures a sanitarium, even though you got millions. That is not a comfortable position to be in. So Roland's pleading now. He assumed he'd stay there another year. It's too final. You know what I mean? It's like you're walking up the gallows or something. But wait a minute, doctor, you're the great doctor. Yeah, there's nothing I can do for you. Zero. Nothing. Yeah, but this is a real first step. This is taking it in spades. And then he said, now I have read of a few cases like yours where people have found a spiritual calling, a spiritual program, a spiritual group of people, and they have experienced a great spiritual psychic change, and they are staying happily sober. So if I was you, I'd go try and find one of those. Now, my point in telling this story is, what if the first time that he came to see Dr. Young, Dr. Young didn't treat him at all, but said, "Hey, you know what you ought to try? You ought to try one of these religious psychic changes. See you later." In other words, a suggestion was being made. Here's what you ought to try. He had not had the rug pulled out from under him yet. And he would have said, "Oh man, that ain't going to do any good. I'll go find someone who will spend a year with me." In other words, the point of the story is, we had to have exhausted every possible alternative until we are willing to do something as drastic as seek a profound psychic change. That's what I get out of that. And Roland did. And he did experience a tremendous relief from the disease of alcoholism and passed the message on to Ebby, and Ebby passed it on to Bill. And so we had a marvelous thing that took place as a result of a psychiatrist saying, "There's nothing I can do for you." Isn't that odd that this is helping us understand our powerlessness? In other words, as we are sitting here thinking, we're going, "Well, am I as bad as Roland?" And the answer is yes. That's what being powerless over alcohol means. That's the type of first step that will give the most open mind possible to doing this transformation coming out of that world and now listening to the principles of the spiritual world. Or the spiritual program, whatever you want to call it. The other thing that Young wrote when he talked to Bill, after Bill wrote him and thanked him for helping him start AA, and he said, "Oh yes, I knew that alcohol was spiritus contrum spiritu, that I knew it was for alcoholics, drinking was a spiritual quest. That they really had a thirst for a spiritual solution and found it in alcohol, and so I saw the connection and I realized that, and yes." And then he just makes a general observation about human beings in general, which I always found interesting. He just is saying, you know, every human being that arrives here has to deal with evil. Now, we would say character defects, but we know what we're talking about. All the things inside of us that don't want us to have it turn out well. You know those things? "Yeah, I know you'd like to stay home and be a nice father, but we have other plans." And away we go. We have a power greater than ourselves pulling us off in many directions. And so here's what Dr. Young says. And people struggle against that. And they always lose. Isn't that terrible? They always lose. And then he goes, with one exception. People who have profound spiritual experiences and are in a society that helps them maintain that spiritual condition. That sounds a little like Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the maintenance of this spiritual connection that is why the fellowship is so important, is to help us maintain it. Just having it is a life-transforming experience. But I think as Bill had that in the hospital, it was almost like two things occur. You have this monumental new way of seeing things, and at the same time, you have this absolute urge to pass it on. "I got to give this to people. I got to give this to people." It's almost like, yes, it's generous that I'm going to go give it to people, but there's also an awareness, if I don't, I'm not going to keep it myself. You know, see what I'm saying about this psychic change or this spiritual awakening, whatever we want to call it. Bill called it a hot flash. Yeah, I had my hot flash up in the hospital. But we all know what he's talking about. He had something rather enormous happen personally to him in his life, and that constituted his own personal awareness that this was true. It's a funny thing about spirituality because C.S. Lewis is another great writer about spiritual things, and he makes this point that there's only one, you know, for the scientific amongst us, the scientists, and we want a proof, we want this and that. He said there's only one laboratory where spiritual experiments can be performed. That's inside of each of us. That's the only place that a spiritual experiment can be performed. And so, in a way, this is what is being asked of us. Once we are willing to accept the desperate nature, we are then said, well, you see the rest of these steps? These will lead to a solution to your situation. Your job is to perform the experiment and see what results you get. So in a way, you can look at this almost as, I'm doing a scientific experiment. They told me if I did this stupid inventory, I would start getting peace of mind. All right, I'll just keep track. I got none now. Okay, here we are, December, what is it, the 10th? December 10th, no peace of mind. 11th, no peace of mind. You know, and then, hey, January 15th, little peace of mind. Just a coincidence. January 16th, hey, what's going on here? Are we seeing results from an experiment? That is a way of, so we're suspending our own control over the management of our lives due to the desperate nature of our situation, but we're still in charge of evaluating the results. And I always like to look at the big picture that way, that's what the deal is. I was telling Sue before dinner that if someone asked me to describe Alcoholics Anonymous, the program, not the fellowship, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in two words, these are the words I would use. Seek God. That's it. That's the whole deal. But first, we're never going to do that unless we have to. You know, you can agree that that probably would be the most healthy, rewarding gift I could give to myself, but I'm not going to do it until I get a yacht. I'm not going to do it until, I mean, there's too much pleasure and there's too much out here. So the only people that we know, people like us, that do that are people who have to. So if you look back on the gifts that are given to us, the gift of desperation is the number one in my book, the gift of desperation. So that now I suddenly go, it's not an option that I seek this. And when I say God, it's God as I understand Him. It doesn't mean any definition. It means something bigger than myself, my own creator, whatever we want to fill in, that I have to get in touch with this. And then we can go back in the early pages of the big book, and it says, tells us what the purpose of the book is. What's the main objective of this book? What is this book for? What is the big book? What is this supposed to do? And it says its main purpose is to enable us to find a power greater than ourselves that will solve our problems. And that gives us right at the very beginning a clue of what spiritual guidelines do. The finding of the power is the solution. That's a very important point to understand. The finding of the power is the solution. We are not given information on how to solve the situation. We simply seek this power, and as we do, problems are removed. There's a big difference between how problems are addressed. They are simply lifted out. I just don't have it. And I think the most classic example is my obsession with alcohol. I mean, you can try to not think about drinking on your own as hard as you want. You remember that? Now, I remember doing that. Yeah, drinking's my problem. I think about drinking all the time. They're right. But I don't want to cave into your solution. So I'm home coming up with, I'm going to teach myself how to not think about drinking. And I'm going to start at 8. As soon as the clock gets to 8. So go ahead. Beer. Okay, now. Here we go. Hey, birds singing. Hi. I'm not thinking. I'm just talking. I'm just going. Budweiser. Okay. I'll start over again, and then I'll go. And any of you that have tried it, the harder you try to not think about alcohol, the more you think about it. It's there. Okay, I get off work in 12 minutes. 12 minutes. I can last 12 minutes. I can quiet down there. Okay, we're going to be fine. 8 minutes. 8 minutes. We'll be getting a drink. Seven. Go. Oh, hold out, guys. We're almost there. No seizure. Come on. Then we go in the bar, and we don't let anybody know we have this problem. And we go ahead and wait on him. I'm not in a hurry. And down inside, there's a whole rebellion going on. What the hell are you talking about? We're not in a hurry. And it's just... So... If you're new, and I know your sponsor's working with you, and you're on this step, the first step. This is... The one Bill says we take 100%. No reservations. I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is totally unmanageable. Meaning, I don't know how to manage my life. I make decisions against my own interest. I'm the last person that should be in charge of me. I mean, that's a big admission. It is not that when you drink, you... lose control. As Clancy said, I've heard him say it many times, that's not a problem. If that's your only problem, then not drinking will solve it. You follow what I'm saying? It's like if you have an allergy to strawberries, but you don't know it. But you know sometimes when you eat, you have this terrible thing and you can't breathe and you're covered with blotches and you feel terrible. And after years of testing, the doctor says it's strawberries. If you simply don't eat strawberries, you will never have any more of those attacks. You'll be absolutely free of the problem. And you don't. You go to your neighbors and they have strawberry shortcake and you say, no thanks, I'm not going to have dessert tonight. It's just, that's it. You got the information and you're on your way. You don't meet with other people who can't eat strawberries. And have a little group in your house. How'd it go today, Tom? Oh, it went okay until I got over to the ice cream place and the strawberry jumped out at me. And so that's not a problem. The fact that when alcohol comes in the system, it destroys us. That is solved by saying to someone, hey, we figured it out. When you drink, everything goes to hell. Just don't drink. Oh, thank you. God, that's very helpful. Really appreciate it. Problem solved. It's all over now. That's not the problem, because what's going on in your head? You're going ahead. If I don't drink, something's going to happen that I don't think I'm going to like. I'm going to be sober all the time. I'm going to be sober 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all month, all year, all the time, and there's never going to be a break. That's what not drinking means to an alcoholic. It's a death sentence. Oh. And then we go, but look, if you drink, and then we can just go, we can just say, look, wait a minute, I know it's going to be hard. But if you do drink, let me show you. I'm going to take you in. I'm going to show you a wet brain. I'm going to show you people in the midnight mission. This is what is going to happen. Do you see? Yeah, yeah, God. Well, I understand now that I'm an alcoholic. And my soul understands that I'm an alcoholic. Now, that's pretty big acceptance. That's pretty big education. I have an understanding of my situation that I never had before. And with this newfound understanding, I'm going to be able to make it. And guess what happens? A month later, we're explaining our situation to our bartender, where we still eat sandwiches. Fred, boy, they told me about alcohol. I can't believe it. Do you know about alcoholism, Fred? Do you realize, were I to have a beer, not only would my liver be shot in 6 months, but my wife will leave me in a week. And my boss said, I'll have a beer. And my boss said, and the bartender watches in absolute astonishment as we explain exactly what's going to happen and drink the beer. So when we say you're powerless over alcohol, we mean when you're sober with no alcohol in your system and you know everything about it. You're still screwed. That doesn't help at all. Is that what you thought your situation was? Or did you think it was a little less than that? Yeah, I got a problem. But I don't have a problem that requires an entire psychic change. Now, why would we be thinking that? Well, guess who loses if you have an entire psychic change? Your ego. Your separate identity. Your I'm the center of the universe. And it is not going to go down without a fight. And as a matter of fact, it fights all the way through all the steps, trying to get control back and never turn over our entire lives to some invisible power. I mean, that's what's in store if you would buy into this. So we start saying, well, it can't be true. This theory, I can't see a higher power. I can't see that. And that's when we go, and the whole book does that. Oh, no, no. We don't talk about that stuff. You know who was the first guy to suggest that we don't talk about that stuff? Dr. Silkworth. Bill was running around trying to sober people up by describing the mountaintop experience and how wonderful it was. Guys! You're not going to believe it. Forget the alcohol. You can have an experience like I did. I was on top of the mountain. I saw God himself. I heard the wind. And when I came out of it a few minutes later, I was free. I was a free man. I'm sitting here. It's the most... wow, it's just great. And nobody was wanting to stop drinking. They'd look at him and go, oh, that happens to me when I drink rum. There's no attraction to the solution without a problem. A solution has no value without a problem. And Silkworth said, Bill, stop talking about that end of the equation. Go to the hopeless nature of the problem. That's how people will come in. And, of course, that's what we do to this day. And we have 60 pages plus 20 describing the first two steps, making sure that when we finish step one, we know in our gut that unless I have a spiritual awakening, I'm not going to make it. Now, make it could mean I'm going to get drunk again and die. Or it could mean I'm going to have a mediocre existence, never getting bad enough so I desperately seek this higher power, but rather kind of a limbo place where I'm sober, but I know there's something wrong. I know there's something missing, but it ain't quite bad enough so that I'm willing to do the work. You know what I'm saying? It is whatever. And I think we can all do it and then coast. And it just gets the sense that all things are well and, you know, I'm fine. But after a while, this thing has to be maintained. It was almost like if an alcoholic, a practicing alcoholic, came and said, God, I had the worst week last week. I just was shaking and hurting and all of that. And you said, well, did you drink? Oh, I forgot. I'm sorry. Thanks. It slipped my mind. Well, that's sort of over here. We're in a spiritual program. We need a spiritual fix every day. And if we don't get it, it's no surprise that we suddenly are restless, irritable, and discontent. Only this is the chance for the ego to jump back in and go, look at what the world's doing to you. It's not me. It's not me. You're maintaining that. You're the spiritual giant and you're getting all upset. Maybe God doesn't like you. Maybe the spiritual stuff really is a bunch of crap. Have you really thought about it? And boy, you give that guy an audience and a microphone. I don't know what lady it was, but there was a circuit speaker. I don't know, it might have been Sharon, who said, our character defects don't go away, they just go off stage and put on a new costume. You know, and we're there walking along and tap on the shoulder, hi. And I turn and I go, you look a little bit like greed. No, that's that other guy. I'm here to help you be more generous. But in order to be more generous, you got to get a lot more dough. So here's the plan. You got to screw this guy on this one deal. One deal only. I know you don't like to lie, but here you're doing it for good. That's how good character defects are. You know, talk about bait and switch. You don't even know you're being conned by you. Oh. So I guess I'm trying to explore every way I can so that each of us can re-inventory that first step. Did we ever leave some little end there that made some illusion that we could somehow not have to give up all control? Why does it have to be that bad? Why does alcoholism have to be that extreme that I have to go over this place? I mean, you know, this stuff here is pretty extreme. A profound psychic change, a spiritual awakening. God, okay, I'm going to give it a try. That was the thing. And that brings us to the second step. The second step would imply, if you were to get people who were used to religions or something like that, and they said, oh, well, here's a very important step. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. The came to believe part. Now, if you were to ask people outside of AA, they would go, oh, came to believe. Let me imagine how that happens. It happens because someone explains this higher power and gives you the history of this higher power and the miracles that this higher power has performed and the history of thousands of years of this power influencing the planet, and it is the most wonderful, supreme, and this, and you study it and you suddenly go, yeah, oh, I see that, and you start coming to believe in this. Well, that's not the process that happens in here. AA has no higher power. There isn't any power that we can bring up on the stage here and go, okay, you finally said you need a higher power. Here it is. Whatever it is. Allah. finally we're going to disclose this power to you. No, there isn't any. So there's no AA God for us to tell you about. So how are we going to get somebody to come to believe in a power greater than himself? Well, how about if we reworded the step just temporarily? Wouldn't you agree, now that we've done the first step 100%, and you're now 15 times as afraid as you were, wouldn't you agree that perhaps, unless there is a higher power, you're screwed? And if you went, it's starting to appear that way. That is called coming to believe. That there really has to be one. And as we believe, it happens. And so we get into that, and Jeff was reading it right out of the chapter of the Agnostic. It's my favorite comedy routine. I'm sorry if I'm boring you with this again, but it is the great thing in step two, the chapter of the Agnostic. It says, if when you drink you have little control over the amount you drink, if when you stop you can't stay stopped, okay, that's it. That's all of us. That's the definition of an alcoholic. If that's your situation, you have a disease that only a spiritual experience can conquer. It's just reinforcing step one. Let me rephrase the problem before we proceed. See the importance of the problem? Just going back to that constantly. Don't forget your problem is this one. It's not my girlfriend left me. That's not your problem. This is the problem. It's a big one. You know what I mean? It would be like you and your girlfriend jump out of a plane and on the way down she says, I'm leaving you. And you go, hey, we're hitting the ground in about 2 seconds. What the hell difference does it make? You see what I mean? There's a bigger problem than that. Somebody leaving you go, yeah. Do you have a parachute? So let's not get sidetracked with minor problems. And forget the biggie. And so that's what Bill Reed, it's almost like we're going to go get you ready for the second step by taking you back to the first step again. And then he says the great Jack Benny line, to be doomed an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. I don't know about you, that's pretty funny. If there's somebody new here, let me explain why it's funny. We finished the first step, and now we're going to have you take your second step up here on the stage. So I call you up, you know, like Bob Barker. Oh, come on up, Henry. Yeah. We're right at the second step. We're ready. Are you ready? Yeah. Okay, well, we got two doors. They're right behind me. All you got to do is choose one door. Okay, yeah. Okay, door number one, die an alcoholic death. Door number two, live on a spiritual basis. Okay, Henry, what's it going to be? And I can tell you what everyone else did. This is what they did. Whoa. And if you like others, Henry, you're going to say, do I get a phone call? And you get a phone call, and you'll call a doctor. And you're going to say, doctor, I have a friend of mine. He's curious. How bad is an alcohol? Oh, God, really? It's that bad. And now you're ready to take step two. Okay, Bob. I'll take door two. Came to believe that I have to go through door two. There's no other door. Bob, is there a third door? No, there's not a third door. Alcoholic death, live on a spiritual basis. Live on a spiritual basis. Well, is there anything that you could do to help me with this live on a spirit, so I could choose door two? Yep, we've been unfair to you, Henry. We've just had you at discussion meetings so far. We're going to take you to a speaker meeting. And you can hear what happens to people who go through door number two. And then you hear a speaker. And you go, holy cow, he hid vodka in the toilet also. He was afraid of everything. He said, oh my God, I can't believe it. That's me up there. What, did you guys tell him my story? And then he's just telling it back because I'm in the audience. I mean, I can't believe that. And then he starts in on how happy he is. And you're looking at him, and it's like he's got a light bulb inside of him somewhere. And it's coming out of his eyes. And he's just describing the world that you live in as a wonderful place. And you look at the world and go, what is he talking about? But I got to admit, I wish I had what he had. Really? Did you say that, Henry? You want what he has? You're on the way. Go through door two. That's what he has. So we have a program of attraction that takes the place of a big book about the higher power. We have a hands-on experience. What if we wanted to talk about spirituality in two different ways? And I don't know where I come with this stupid analogy, but I like telling it, so I'll keep going. What if they found a tribe? You know how they're always finding tribes that they didn't know existed on the planet? Well, they found this one in a cave system in South America. Never, totally unaware of modern civilization. Been living in there. There's rivers that go in, bring fish, and animals will come in and they get them, and they get fires, and that's their light. And they just lived there all their lives. And some anthropologists found them, and they decided to do it differently this time. They're not going to just rush them out and give them a shock. They're going to take maybe 20 years to accustom them to the fact that there is this unbelievable world out there. And they come up with different ways they're going to do it. But one of the things they feel they have to explain and get across to them before they get out is electricity. Because this is such an integral part of everything, and it's invisible. You can't see it. And so they came up with two ways they were going to try. The first way, which was the intellectual way, was... and this I would compare to churches, was to explain electricity over a period of 5 or 6 years until this very primitive person had an idea of what an electron was and resistance and wires and all of that and could pass a college test on electricity. They felt then they had communicated to that person a great deal about electricity. Now, that was the one school. The other school said, well, this is what we think. We think we'll set up a generator out there and we'll run a wire in. And then we'll bring a light, a lamp, and we'll say, come over here and watch this. And we'll hook the two wires up to the lamp. And then we'll take a bulb and we'll screw it in. And then we'll go click. And they'll get to see light. And they'll go, whoa, whoa, whoa. We won't say a word. And then we'll unscrew the bulb and we'll tell him to stick his finger in the socket. And he does, and he goes, yo, whoa, whoa. And the question is, which guy knows more about electricity? AA uses the second approach. They show you a spiritually illumined person who shouldn't be that happy. I mean, they're sick, or they got something going on, and the business isn't doing that well, and their kid just ran away, and here they are. Life is great. Come on in. This is when you're going, what is that? And they're just radiating, and the circumstances don't justify that. And we grab your finger and stick it in a light socket, which is what the steps do. They lead to your own voltage, and you are aware of something that you don't understand. And it turns out you don't have to understand it to use it. You don't have to understand it at all to have it work. You can go and on your own personal journey and try to have a name for this marvelous transforming power, or you can just keep your finger in the socket and call it whatever you want. Well, ouch. Sure glad you're in my life, because you transform everything every time I touch you. And so the second step is coming to believe, first of all, that unless there's a higher power, and second of all, that other people have demonstrated it, and that based on that, the desperate circumstances and the fact you've gotten a glimpse of it, you are willing to proceed and go through that second door and hopefully never look back. Don't come back and go, oh, I think I'll stay out here. Just continue on that journey. Bob asked me to, I'm going to wrap up shortly, to relay what my sponsor did. This was the ultimate spiritual test. Are you ready? This is my sponsor's way of getting me spiritual. It was, you know, a number of months. I mean, we're probably a year and a half or something like that, because early on we didn't get into the steps, and then it was a big deal. And he said, now would you level with me about your spiritual side? I was brought up Catholic, and I took off out of the church like a shot the second I could. Scared me to death. I saw the crucifix, and my interpretation was, that's what God did, his only son he loved. What's he going to do to me? You know, very frightening thing. And he said, would you be honest with me? I'm going to ask you a few spiritual questions. Yes, Bill, I'll be honest. How much do you pray? I said, Bill, I don't pray at all. I don't believe in prayer. I went to the church. It's stupid. There's no one listening. Sorry, Bill. Put me down. Zero praying. Okay? At least you're being honest. Zero praying. Good. Okay, how often do you go to church? I don't go to church, Bill. I don't even like to go in looking at churches. Like a cathedral in Paris. Forget it. Zero. Okay, zero. That's fine. That's fine. Okay, now meditation. How often do you sit and contemplate? I don't. I'm busy, Bill. I'm trying to earn a living. I got six kids. No. No. Okay, zero. So zero, zero, zero. Last one. Do you ever read spiritual books? Do you ever read, try and get guidance, to try and get, expand your horizon? No, Bill, I don't. That's all crap. I've looked at the people in the New Age section. Oh, God. Zero, zero. Then he asked the spiritual jackpot question. So how's it going? You remember the answer? Awful. Okay, zero prayer, zero this, zero, zero. Awful. You see a connection? And so that brings us to, I think, the end of this. Wait a minute. There's a line at the end of the chapter of the agnostic. And then I'll wrap up. I don't know why I think it's important. But that is the end of the second step. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it's only there that he may be found, and so it was with us. And at the very end, he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. And the last sentence, C, before we get to step three, God could and would if he were sought. And so I think that the first two steps are designed to make seekers out of us, granted out of desperation, but also out of attraction for the result that the seeking of this unnamed power is visible to our eyes in the meetings and in the lives of our fellow alcoholics. And so in a strange way, the disease of alcoholism has selected us for a very exclusive club of seekers, of people who, through no virtue of their own, have been gathered together with an opportunity to possibly experience the whole point of being alive, so that it's no longer a mystery. We just go, God, it's so obvious what the whole point is, to be of service. That's it. That's why I'm here. God stuck me here. Like Chuck, every time he'd say, we're just God's kids. You go help that kid. And I'll take care of you. And that's what happened. And so I think the point of one and two is to begin to make us a seeker and to begin the journey, and the rest of the steps show how this seeking is done. Thank you all very much. I appreciate the chance.